I didn't think that Nazi camp got out until 8. Did you decide to skip arts and crafts?
Catapults and propaganda.
Alien race to come down and train us.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to Wednesday evening. Oh, two more days and we hit the weekend.
It's all downhill from here.
Well, if that means that we don't have to work as hard, yay!
Well, just for the week, just speaking for the week, not for the rest of our lives.
I'm still painting doors. Are you kidding? And this weekend, you get to help.
I can't
wait. Not that you haven't been a big help. You know, he painted the stairwell, and if you've ever painted a stairwell, you can appreciate.
Without a ladder.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that
he
was
just jumps up, does a swipe, and jumps again.
Murphy was giving me lessons on the leaping. Thank you for joining us here tonight. It is 8 o'clock bunker savings time, and we've got the second part of our interview with Peter Lavenda tonight, Nazis and the Occult. And we will get to that after we take a look around and see what is going on in this world.
What is going on in the world? Well, of course, the big news every day everyone is talking about is what's taking place. Two big stories today. One is what's taking place in the Gaza Strip, and the mm-hmm. other one, of course, what's taking place on the Eastern Seaboard here in the United States.
Right. Well, the fighting in the Gaza Strip looks pretty intense. I mean, it seems to me. And I don't profess to be an expert on Middle Eastern affairs, but it seems to me that what's happening here is that Israel is doing more than just trying to recover the kidnapped corporal. They're trying to send a message
mm-hmm.
that you better toe the line or we're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, Hamas isn't listening. It's supposed to be Fatah Party who's doing the kidnapping, but I think it's pretty clear that Hamas is behind mm-hmm. it, if not doing everything.
Yeah.
Fatah's pretty much just becoming a little puppet. But we've seen at least a second and probably a third kidnapping take place.
Mm-hmm.
The Israeli Defense Forces are not taking this lightly.
No.
They're storming in fact.
Well, responding to a kidnapping with tanks is...
I know. I have such mixed feelings about the whole thing.
Yeah, it is a really...
How many lives do you take in order to make your point?
Yeah. And... it was interesting in that today at the office, the guys that I work with are pretty much salt of the earth types. I'd say fairly typical for this part of the country in terms of their political views and views of the world. And in the 10 years that I've worked there, I've pretty much been solidly behind Israel anytime a conflict shows up in the news. But today they were saying, you know, they took out the power plant for the Gaza Strip, the only power source for the people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
So that every man, woman and child on the Gaza Strip is now without water and without power
mm-hmm.
because a few connected to Hamas or Fatah, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Hamas says, yeah, we attacked the Israeli military post, but we didn't kidnap the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever is responsible. Every woman and child on the Gaza Strip is now without the basic necessities of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that strategy is, oh, they'll turn in the people who got this
yeah.
soldier who kidnapped him. But we're not dealing, or the Israelis aren't just dealing with people who want to do harm. They're dealing with an ideology, and they mm-hmm. know it very, very well. These people have this tiny, tiny little Gaza Strip. It's a tiny area.
Mm-hmm.
They've withstood a lot.
Yes, they have.
With
and,
very little. And I'm not saying that I'm rooting for either side, mm-hmm. but it really angers me when I see, you know, Israel has to, for a small nation, has an awfully big military presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. A big part of their annual GDP goes towards military.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, frankly, that wouldn't be possible were it not for financial support from the United States.
Yeah, and well, I guess, you know, being where they are, they're surrounded by enemies, so to speak. So I guess you can understand why they have to have a
right, yeah.
Presence.
This is such an intertwined complex nest of issues that it will never be untangled this side of Christ's return.
No,
that's all there
true.
Is to it.
And again, we need to make a differentiation between the government of Israel mm-hmm. and the people of God. There's
right.
a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you look back at the Old Testament, there was rarely a good government of mm-hmm. Israel. And God said, "You don't. I'm your king."
Right.
No, we want a king. We mm-hmm. want a government. So, okay.
And when you look through the books of Chronicles and Kings, you see the few who are good are really mentioned and highlighted by mm-hmm. The chroniclers.
Mm-hmm.
And there were not that many. Josaphat, Asa, Hezekiah.
Yeah, not very many. But
Joachim,
a
few others.
The rats that were in there.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of men. So, it looks like this government now is just about as corrupt.
Right. And let's face it, as Americans, with a strong evangelical streak that has run through this country from its inception, the temptation has been there and is being used by certain political groups in the United States and in Israel to play on that to secure American support for the government of Israel. Israel, the government, has no stronger friend in the world than American evangelical Christians.
That's the truth. Dominionists.
Dominionists, right.
Yeah.
And as true Christians, we need to step back and say, now, wait just a minute here. We need to look at this issue and really evaluate this in light of what Jesus Christ said, which were, number one, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. Number two, love your neighbor as you love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And there are an awful lot of innocents on both sides in this conflict who are being harmed because of the political aspirations and machinations
mm-hmm.
of men who are benefiting from the fight.
Well, speaking of the fight, the IDF, I don't even know if they call themselves the IDF anymore, but anyway, the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
They went so far as to buzz the Syrian palace.
Yes, yes. Hafez Assad.
Hi!
Yeah.
Just it was to reportedly, know we could bomb you anytime.
Yeah, yeah. He was reportedly not at his summer palace when the four F-16s flew by at about 50 feet over the top of the building. But they sent a very strong message that if we had wanted to, this palace could be nothing but a smoking pile of rubble right
mm-hmm.
now. They've done this before, where they've flown so close over Assad's home that they basically shattered all the glass in the house.
Mm-hmm. Now picture someone flying over, the White House doing that.
Mm. You would hope that they wouldn't be able to.
Well, they shouldn't be able to, and you wouldn't think that they would have been able to fly over this place either, but they did.
It doesn't speak well of the anti-aircraft defenses of Syria.
Well, the Syrian anti-aircraft folks are, there's a story out, and you can read it on Watcher Magazine. We fought back. We shot them. We aimed our guns.
Mm-hmm.
We shook our fists.
Well, it is interesting that they buzzed the summer palace instead of his home, and he was at home instead of at the summer palace. But still, it is a very strong message. We could have done it if we had wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And it only ratchets up the tensions in the area. And, of course, the implication is that we know you're responsible for what's going on in the Gaza Strip, and we want you to call it off.
Yep, that, of course, was the whole point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because Hamas, the training camps, the money,
mm-hmm.
a lot of it comes out of Syria.
And Iran.
Yes. And Syria and Iran are big buddies.
In fact,
they've been very public about that.
And have just recently formalized a mutual defense pact,
mm-hmm.
which could result in Iranian soldiers being based in or near the Golan Heights.
And the deal is if anything happens to Iran or if anything happens to Syria,
mm-hmm.
the other country will come to its aid.
Mutual defense pact,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So things are getting more and more interesting. And, of course, anytime there is any sort of tension over there, it has prophetic implications.
But you know what? This area has been a powder keg for decades.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Who knows what will happen? We may end up, you and I may end up becoming old people.
Sure.
Sitting at a holographic, computer doing our show.
We'll just be brains in jars floating in our...
I bid four quatloos on Syria.
A little Star Trek reference for you there. Well, yeah, it is interesting because obviously this goes back, to the days of King Saul and before. But as the tensions ratchet up, you know, I had a point, and I'm just kind of tap dancing here.
We don't get nearly enough carbs in this household.
That's probably the problem.
Because, you know, your brain runs on glucose.
Where's that sugar bowl? So, well, it will be interesting to see what happens here. And it's not, whatever it is, you can bet there's going to be more shooting involved. And
well, in the meanwhile, here is Gideon Shalit, you know, who is he was the first soldier to be taken captive. And I don't know, I haven't seen a story. I checked just before we went to record this. I see nothing in the press about his release or his rescue yet. But I try to imagine what it would be like to sit in his shoes, stand in his shoes at this point, knowing that in order to be rescued, he's a military man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know he's young. He's only 19. So that's a real stretch for me to think, okay, I'm a military man and I'm only 19 and I have black hair. So much to stretch. But to sit there and think, not only are my fellow soldiers risking their lives to come and find me, but there are women and children who are in harm's way mm-hmm. because of this. And he must have all kinds of mixed emotions.
Yeah. It's an ugly situation. And I remembered where I was starting, you know, the path I was starting to travel here.
I just sort of danced until you...
And I appreciate that, sweetheart.
Yeah, it's okay, honey.
The situation there, one could argue, just taking a little bit of an historic perspective of this conflict, that much of this was set up by the events of World War One and America's entry into World War One. It is very likely that Woodrow Wilson's decision to commit American forces to World War One, after running for president, by the way, on a promise of not getting entangled in a European war, prolonged the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
That there would very likely have been a negotiated settlement in 1915 or 16, which would have allowed the Ottoman Empire, which controlled the Middle East at that time, to survive in some form for a while longer.
Mm-hmm.
But because the United States entered the war, prolonged it until 1918, and then resulted in a settlement that penalized the losers, which was the Ottoman Empire, Germany, of course. Not only did the British wind up with their mandate in Palestine, which then allowed Winston Churchill to carve, you know, create Iraq out of separate territories.
Mm-hmm. People was it the Balfour Declaration? Or was that later?
Well, the Balfour Declaration basically said we would eventually, you know, agree to an independent Israel. If I remember correctly, the Balfour Declaration, I think, was about 1914.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right.
So,
okay.
But Churchill was, you know, basically bolted together the northern Iraq, the Kurdish territory with the central Iraq Sunni territory, and then the Shia territory in the south, you know, Basra, Baghdad, and then the northern Mosul area into one big country. People who don't like each other.
Oh.
And who fight like cats and dogs. And then established the Hashemite kingdom and put a Sunni on the throne. And so from the 30s until we overthrew Saddam Hussein, a Sunni, which are the minority in Iraq, ruled the majority Shia population and created a lot of the conflict and problems that have gone on there, you know, in addition to what, you know, has gone on in with an independent Israel.
Well, it's interesting that you go back to World War One, because there are those who have the school of thought that believes that there is not a World War One and a World War Two.
That it was
all one war.
One war. Well, Eric John Phelps has made that point, and he makes a very good point. It is interesting, too, though, with Churchill playing such an influential role in the creation of Iraq that, as we mentioned during our interview with Peter Goodgame, he chose the name of Nimrod's ancient kingdom, which was based in the city of Uruk, U-R-U-K, or as the Bible records it, Erech, E-R-E-C-H.
Mm-hmm.
Just spell it I-R-A-Q. It's the same name. Why did they choose that name for the name of the country? Things that make you go, especially because that is the guy that the Masons basically venerate. So
yeah. Well, now that we're 13 minutes in, we can officially go to the next story.
That's right.
Which is the eastern seaboard of the United States is underwater.
Yes, it is soggy. And not to make light of a terrible situation.
As of right now, there are 16 people dead.
Yes. The only positive news that's come out of this is that the Internal Revenue Service offices have been closed for days now because they've got water flooding their two basement levels. But you're right, 16 deaths is nothing to laugh about, and the property damage and people who have been displaced from their homes is really it's hard to conceive. Now, in the St. Louis area, we have some experience with it. You weren't here when that happened back in 93,
but
I was.
No, but I saw the news footage on television.
Right. And the area where I work now and have worked for the last 10 years was under 8 feet of water. Yeah, until last summer, there was a light pole across the parking lot that had a white stripe 8 feet off the ground to mark the high water line. The fellows at the office were visited by somebody from the Army Corps of Engineers on a Friday morning at about 10 a.m. and said, we can't order you to leave, but we would strongly suggest it.
Well, you work in a valley.
Yes,
that is
along
part
the Missouri
of the
River.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not too far from where we live here in the bunker is another valley that's down by the Merrimack River. And there's a town down there that is sadly inundated occasionally.
Valley Park, right.
We sit on an extremely high point in the county. So if the water's ever reached here,
the Midwest, as we know it, would be underwater. So, but we did see a lot of people who were displaced, and there were a lot of areas you could not drive. It was very difficult to get from St. Louis County to St. Charles County, which is, you know, west of here.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Missouri was, there is a levee system that protects the valley in which my office is located now, which was designed to protect against a 100-year flood. The flood of 93 was a 500-year flood, and that's what's happening to the east coast of the United States right now. They've just been getting inundated.
And there are dams. In fact, there was a dam that they were discussing earlier that was probably going to fail, an earthen dam on a lake. And when those things fail, you just have this rush of water. You know, many of our listeners, I know you know what we're talking about. So we need to really pray for everybody, not just the people who are over in the Middle East, but also the people in harm's way and those who are suffering, you know, consequently. You know, they may not be in harm's way, but frankly, I tell you what, if you get areas that are primary corridors for transportation and for manufacturing, a lot of these things can affect every one of us.
Yes. And these sorts of things are happening all over the world. Comes news from Africa that there are 2 million people now in Uganda, which, well, I'm ashamed to admit, I thought was one of the more stable nations in Africa of late. You know, since the days of Idi Amin, things have really turned around in Uganda. But 2 million people are now living in refugee camps in Uganda.
They call themselves the Lord's
The Lord's Army.
Yes, and that I hate that. But this
is the Lord's Resistance Army. Sorry.
Exactly. And many, many people have been displaced. And you know, Derek and I were talking about this before we started doing the show tonight. And there's a certain amount of stress, as anyone who has ever moved, there's a certain amount of stress that goes along with it. Just thinking, okay, what do I have to do today? What do I need to do tomorrow? Aside from the physical labor of just physically moving. And it's easy to, also when you're selling a house, there's that stress, but it's really easy to sit and start thinking, oh, poor me.
Sure.
When I see stories like this, God is able to slap me up one side and down the other and tell me how wonderful each moment of my life is and how these minor stresses are nothing compared to someone who is trying to figure out how she's going to find fresh water for her baby that day.
Right. There's another part of the world that we don't pay much attention to here in the West that we should take notice of. They've gone through several waves of violence in recent years, and this is East Timor, which is an island in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. It's part, well, it was formerly part of Indonesia. They recently received independence and helped out by Australian troops several years ago to kind of stabilize things. And there's recently been a lot of unrest and violence as a rebel group has basically risen up against the ruling government. There are some indications, though, although you won't read this in the mainstream media, that there are agents of Western governments that are working to agitate in East Timor. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny little nation. It's sort of like, you know, Haiti, you know, where it's like half the island, you mm-hmm. know. East Timor is half of this island. The other half belongs to Indonesia. But there is a lot of petroleum that has been discovered on the shelf offshore mm-hmm. East Timor.
And that is, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to say, when you see unrest like this, mm-hmm. that just keeps going and going and going, and it just seems, it's where did this come from?
Right.
And suddenly they're asking, could the UN send somebody? Can NATO send somebody in? Please, we need help here. Mm-hmm. It's like the story you did last week with Nicole on Cape Verde. I mean, what is there?
Yeah, why
is this a strategic location? Who right. would want this and why?
You need to look beyond just the headlines. This isn't just a group rising up and throwing rocks at government buildings just for the fun of it. There are powerful Western interests, Australian, American, British, European, that want to get the drilling rights offshore East Timor, because apparently some of these blocks, as they call them, are mm-hmm. have a lot of oil underneath the seabed. And the ruling party in East Timor, as I understand the story anyway, and I won't claim to be 100% informed here, but was not inclined to bargain away a natural resource for his new fledgling country. They wanted, in fact, troops from Portugal to come help them out. If I understand correctly, Portugal is one of the nations that they trust. But instead, they've got Australian peacekeepers in there now. Hmm. And it appears that the government of John Howard in Australia is sort of acting like the deputy sheriff for, Sheriff George in Washington, D.C., and that we will probably see Western petroleum companies soon floating offshore rigs off the coast of East Timor.
Well, we may see them off the coast of Florida.
Well, we may.
I know that legislation is going around again. Offshore drilling, we need more stuff. That whole, there's a treaty that we have with Cuba that says we won't drill in certain areas. And there are people in Congress who are saying, well, you know, we really need to do that. It's not a story that's on Watcher today. It was there a couple of days ago. But I think that more and more we're going to find that oil is a huge driving factor when it comes to geopolitics.
Right. And the key thing to remember is that it's not about securing enough supply for our needs. It's about controlling everyone else's supply.
Mm-hmm.
There's a study out, and we should have talked about this the last couple of days, and it always seemed to be something else that got in the way. But the Associated Press ran a story on the 24th of this month. It said the U.S. Geological Survey will review a study by a North Dakota geologist who estimated that Western North Dakota and Eastern Montana have more oil than the Alaskan Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, ANWR. You may have been hearing all the mm-hmm. fighting mm-hmm. that's been going on in Congress over drilling in ANWR. North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan has asked the Geological Survey to review the work of Lee Price, who worked for the U.S. Geological Survey and wrote this study in 1999. And apparently it's been on the shelf for the last 7 years. He died in 2000 before other scientists had a chance to review it. His study estimates that there could be as much as 400 billion with a B barrels of oil in this formation in western North Dakota and eastern Montana.
That's a lot.
To compare, that would be about twice as much as the proven reserves in Saudi Arabia. Right there in North Dakota.
In your face, Saudi Arabia!
Yeah. So the question then is, if we've got potentially twice as much oil in North Dakota and Montana,
uh-huh. why aren't we drilling?
Why aren't we drilling there?
Yeah.
And ANWR could have as many as 200 billion barrels also.
Yeah.
So why?
Why have we protected so many areas that, and yet we'll go, oh, well, your country's got some. Yoink.
Yeah, why are we fussing around in all the stands in Central Asia? Well, it's because it's not about making sure that you and I have enough oil that we can pay a dollar a gallon for gasoline. It's about making sure that Russia doesn't control the world's oil supply, mm-hmm. or China, or India.
It's a big game of risk.
Yes, that's what it is.
Again, get that board game.
And they're playing it with the blood of American soldiers, English soldiers, Australian soldiers, and that
is repugnant. And that gets to the spiritual component because blood sacrifices are very important in that realm.
Yes.
Well, you know, here's another story that's just a total, you know, change. Do you have a Dell laptop in your home? Does it sometimes get a little hot?
Huh.
Well. This,
the picture at Watcher Magazine is striking.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. I would not want that on my lap when it, blows up like that.
Yeah.
These pictures have been floating around the internet for a couple days, apparently. Reuters has published it today, and it just shows a Dell laptop in flames.
Yes.
It's spontaneous laptop combustion.
You know, I've read about that thing. I didn't think that it was really scientifically feasible, but apparently it can happen.
Well, Dell is going to examine it and find out what's going on. Apparently they had recalled some of their laptops because of problems with batteries overheating. Mm-hmm. And
anyone who uses a laptop a lot can probably relate to a hot battery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of things, conflagrations and things catching fire, there is another accident to report from a Chinese coal mine.
Oh, you know, I know that they have a lot of coal mines, and I do know that China is trying to get off the coal standards, so to speak, mm-hmm. and move over to more things that are oil and nuclear. But even if you go with lots of nuclear, you still need coal, so they're going to have to continue mining it.
Well, that's it. And China's safety standards leave something to be desired. 22 miners died yesterday. At least 22 miners have died in an explosion in a northeastern province. Four others are still missing. 37 were injured. And this comes about a month after 56 miners died in a flood. They just got the last of the bodies out yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. How's this for a statistic? In 2005... 5,986 miners died in China.
Well, that's a horrendous number. And I have to say that it doesn't surprise me that it's that high because, as I've said on this show before, not a day goes by that mm-hmm. I don't find a story. That's why I don't report them all.
Right.
Every day there are at least one, if not more, stories about an accident and a mine in China.
Yeah. Well, it's an average of about 15 a day. I mean,
well,
that's
there
horrible.
Are a lot of unregulated mines apparently over there.
80% of the world's coal mining accidents and fatalities take place in China.
Oh.
So, sadly, there are 22 more who were added to that list just yesterday. And there's one other thing I wanted to mention here. This I want to rant a little bit more about the Episcopal Church USA.
Well, we've gone a second 13 minutes, so
move on to the next story
rant
here.
Into there, yeah,
actually, not to rant, just to more fallout from their convention last week, where they voted to kind of rein in their practice of consecrating more openly homosexual bishops,
mm-hmm.
while at the same time voting in a woman as their presiding bishop, one who is openly supportive of ordaining more gay bishops. Three conservative dioceses.
It's Greek.
Yeah, well, they put an S on the end of it in the story.
Well, they shouldn't have.
Anyway, three conservative dioceses that oppose consecrating gay bishops have asked the Archbishop of Canterbury to appoint an alternative leader for them.
Really?
Yes. They do not want to be subject to the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, which would be the Right Reverend Shorey. Catherine Jeffords Shorey. So we'll see what happens there. Meanwhile, the liberal Diocese of Newark, New Jersey, which is the diocese that gave us John Shelby Spong,
mm-hmm.
has nominated four priests as candidates to become their next bishop, one of whom is an open homosexual. So...
this story's not going to go away.
The Episcopal Church USA is fracturing and splitting apart.
Well, I have one last story before we go to our guest. If you've ever wished that you could take your dog to work.
Now you have a reason, yeah.
Well, there are places, apparently, that are starting to allow that because studies show
mm-hmm.
that those people that are allowed to bring their pets to work are more productive.
That's really interesting, because you'd think that they'd just be a distraction.
Murphy's been saying all along that if you just let him go with you, not only would he help with the filing, but he would also keep, you know, predators away from your cubicle.
Yeah.
And
that'd be good.
He would, you know, help you nap when you need to.
That's good. You know, it would be a lot less stressful to be able to scratch a fluffy dog when you're in the middle of some tough negotiating.
Oh, gosh. This is a great story. And there are links to dogster.com, which is a great site that allows you to put up a website just for your pet.
Cool.
And simplyhired.com that apparently lists companies that are dog friendly.
Huh. That is really neat.
So there you go.
Interesting information in that survey.
Yeah. And of course, speaking of dogs, we're still trying to find a home for Murphy. So please, if you can add that to your prayer list, we'd really appreciate
it. Yeah.
That.
And if you want to see a picture of Murphy without the tinfoil hat and with his summertime haircut, you know, his summer buzz cut, look at watchermagazine.com and look for the story about the canine coworker.
Or just go to peeringintodarkness.com main page. That poster that I made up for him.
Yep.
It's there.
Ah, excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, we've got a guest.
Yes, Peter Lavenda. Fascinating guy. Interesting life. Love to have him back again just to talk about his own personal experiences in the years that he spent researching the book Sinister Forces and the Unholy Alliance,
yeah.
Especially the time that he spent down at Colonia Dignidad.
I know. I was thinking that very thing. You know, I know he's told that stories on other shows, and I think we sort of skirted around it when we mm-hmm. interviewed him the first time, but I'd like to hear him go into depth again with us.
Yeah. Well, as we said, the influence of the Nazi Party did not end with the end of World War II. And we discussed that with Peter Lavenda. And here is part two of our interview with the author of Unholy Alliance, Peter Lavenda. We continue with author Peter Lavenda and a discussion of his book, Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. We discussed yesterday the underpinnings of the Nazi Party and its basis in the Thule Society. Peter, there were some very interesting scientific expeditions that were undertaken at the behest of Heinrich Himmler, especially the ones into the Himalayas. What were they all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the doctrine, very complicated doctrine of the Nazi Party regarding the superiority of the German people, was this idea that the Germans were part of something called the Aryan race. And the Aryan race were believed to have originated somewhere either in the Caucasus or in the Himalayan mountains themselves. Himmler believed that Tibet held the secrets of the origins of the Aryan people. So he financed expeditions to Tibet to try to find out as much as possible about their religion, about their scriptures, their occult practices. All of this he needed brought back to Germany. And he was financing these expeditions as late as 1937-38. Which means right when the war was starting to get hot and right when international tensions were at their highest, Himmler had sent a group of scientists to Tibet, claiming these were the first white people to visit Tibet, which of course was not true, but those are the claims made in the newspapers, and had sent these organizations out there to find out what they could about Tibetan mysticism and Tibetan religion. He had sent a number of people who were actually well-known archaeologists of the time, not just in Germany, but internationally well-known, who were members of a group within the SS called the Ahnenerbe, which was the Ancestral Heritage Research Division of the SS. Ancestral heritage is the key. Trying to find out not only the origins of the German people, or the Aryan people, but exactly how far afield you could find evidence that the Germans had lived and had helped develop societies, civilizations around the world. So basically what happened was you sent archaeologists to various places, to Asia, to the Taklimakan Desert, which is in the far western part of China and north of Pakistan, and to dig around and see if they could find pots with, you know, swastikas inscribed on them that were thousands of years old. If they could do that, they were happy. They figured that was evidence the Aryans had been there. Of course, the swastika is an ancient symbol. I mean, everyone, you'll find swastikas used by American Indians. You'll find them used in China among Chinese Buddhists, for instance. In India, it's a very popular symbol. So you're almost guaranteed to find swastikas almost anywhere on Earth. And this gave credence to the German claim that the Aryans were once the masters of human civilization. So he sent, as I mentioned, this one expedition to Tibet. They came back with newsreel footage, with which you can still see. It's been some of this footage has been replayed on various television stations, for instance, on the History Channel, places like that, when they do a special on this. You'll see some of this very old footage that was taken by the Nazis while they were there. And photographs of religious rituals. They took back a lot of artifacts. They took back the Tibetan scriptures, an entire copy of those. They brought on the backs of mules and camels across dangerous mountain passes. All of this was being done just before the war actually broke out. But there was another element to this as well. Some Tibetans and an entire group of people in India believe that Hitler was a spiritual leader, was an avatar. And one of the reasons they thought this was, of course, the use of the swastika, which to the Indians is a very sacred symbol. So they began to think that maybe Hitler was coming to free them, liberate them from the British. You know, India at that time was a British colony.
Right.
So you had leaders like Chandra Bose, who was a very popular Indian nationalist leader, who virtually worshipped Hitler, wrote a lot of articles about the Nazi Party, a lot of articles about Germany. A lot of articles about Hitler promoting this idea that Hitler was going to be their spiritual liberator. And his idea was to raise an army in India to meet Hitler's forces when they crossed the Suez Canal into the Middle East. They would join up and then take over the rest of the world from there. So you had this very strong idea among a lot of Indians and some Tibetans that maybe the Nazi Party was a spiritual force to be reckoned with, and maybe that it was on their side. One of the archaeologists, before we move from that subject, one of the archaeologists on that Tibet expedition is a man called Bruno Beger.
Yes.
This is a person that sort of shows you what we're dealing with. Here was a perfectly innocuous expedition to Tibet, we might say. I mean, nobody was being killed. Nobody was being tortured. These were scientists on a mission of discovery. They come back to Germany in 1938. By 1938-39, the war is starting to break out. Hitler's invaded Poland, Czechoslovakia. It's all starting to happen. He's taken back Austria. And the first camps, the first concentration camps, are being set up. One of the most famous was at Dachau. And at Dachau, they performed a lot of medical experiments. Well, one of the archaeologists and scientists involved in these experiments was Bruno Beger himself. The man who went to Tibet later came back to Germany and was one of the people, or the person, responsible for selecting human skulls for a museum of race. And he would collect these skulls by visiting live prisoners at Dachau and deciding which skulls he wanted and telling the authorities to kill these people and preserve the skulls and have them sent to him. So here was this monster engaged in hideous activities during the war, only a year before had been visiting Tibet, the land of the Dalai Lama, the land of mysticism and peace and compassion. So, you know, what was this all about? You know, it makes me sometimes wonder a little bit also about the Dalai Lama, who had a number of Nazis as friends during that time, who had befriended him when he was a young man.
Right.
Heinrich Harrer, the adventurer who wrote 7 Years in Tibet, which they made the movie with Brad Pitt. Playing him. I mean, here was an SS officer, you know, who downplayed his role in the SS when he was writing about his trip in Tibet. But the reason he was in Tibet was because the war had broken out. He was in India, which was British territory. He fled to Tibet and for years soaked up, you know, Tibetan doctrine as well. But he was only one of many Germans and Nazis and SS officers who had been to Tibet and were doing the same sorts of things.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Bruno Beger. There's a picture on the Dalai Lama's website, the official Government of Tibet and Exiles website, dated 1994, which features the Dalai Lama standing with a group of Westerners, among whom are Mr. Heinrich Harrer and Dr. Bruno Beger,
right,
who remained friends of his into the 90s. Now, it's not likely that the Dalai Lama was unaware of their affiliations or their actions, given the amount of attention that had been paid to, the Nazi Party in the aftermath of World War II. So, which raises another question. What similarities, parallels, or connections might there have been between the particular type of tantric Buddhism practiced by the Dalai Lama and the beliefs of the Nazi Party.
Wow. Well, there you struck on it. I mean, you struck on what's probably going to be the material for at least a dozen doctoral theses that I can think of. I mean, you're right there at the crux of the matter. I mean, what was the connection? How was the Dalai Lama, I mean, whom we credit with such spiritual sensitivity, how was he able to stand next to someone like Bruno Beger? I mean, here was a man responsible, and it's documented. His atrocities are well known. I mean, there's no escaping it. Heinrich Harrer, well, we could go either way. He was an SS officer, which meant automatically, after the war, he was considered an enemy, a war criminal, as was Beger himself. So you ask yourself, you know, how could the Dalai Lama, you know, really stand there and accept these people? As I said in Unholy Alliance, what did he know, and, you know, and when did he know it?
Mm-hmm.
The old Watergate question. But Tibetan Tantra and the practices of Tibetan Tantra are not pure Buddhism in the sense that we understand it from India and from the Gautama Buddha and the Buddhist scriptures. Tibetan Tantricism comes from another source. I mean, it's much older, and Buddhism is kind of a veneer over it. You have the native Tibetan religion, which is called Bern, B-O-N with an umlaut over the O, so pronounced sort of Bern, the Bern religion, which was a pagan faith. Very complicated, but which also has a number of things that we might object to in their ritual repertoire. You know, some of the implements that they use are made out of human skulls and human bones, for instance.
Yeah.
They believe in contacting the spiritual forces. They're kind of shamanistic that way. There's all sorts of deep rituals involving blood and involving sacrifice. So, you know, what was the relationship between that and the Nazis? Did the Dalai Lama see some kind of finer connection between the two cultures that we don't see or that we're only beginning to see? It's a fascinating question. It deserves a lot further examination because we're too ready to accept the sort of Richard Gere version of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, the kind of all peaceful, all compassionate version. There's another element to it, and there's been a lot of infighting in Tibet. Even before the Chinese invaded, there has been a lot of people nominated as Dalai Lama who mysteriously died after a couple of months or a year. A lot of internecine warfare there. So the picture that is presented is one that is beautiful and worthy of emulation, but the history tells you something else.
It was very telling statement, let's say a very astute statement that was made by Christopher Hitchens some years back, who made the observation that the Dalai Lama has somehow reached a point in the public perception that he is judged by his reputation rather than by his words and actions.
Right.
Yeah, which
and,
is,
yeah, I read that, and it's. I have to agree, although I don't always agree with Christopher Hitchens, in this case his remarks on Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, I think, were rather astute.
Yeah. Were there other sources of power that Himmler and or the Nazis tried to tap for their own purposes?
Absolutely. I mean, the journey to Tibet was only one of the things that Himmler was financing. He definitely wanted to find the Holy Grail. This was something that was of tremendous importance to him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit about that in my book as well, and I think other researchers are now going and looking at this. He was financing a search for the Grail. Very similar to the Indiana Jones film concept that we're familiar with, but that's based on reality. The Nazis were trying to find artifacts of power, relics of different religions, of different faiths. It didn't matter. But as long as they were believed to have spiritual power within them, the Nazis wanted them, and they financed expeditions everywhere. Tibet was only one of these. The other was the search for the Grail, and they had a young SS officer, Otto Rahn, that they sent looking for it. And Ron was a kind of archaeologist, anthropologist, who studied the Cathars, the Knights Templar, and all of these things, which have become now a bit better known with the Da Vinci Code. And here he was in the 1930s searching, you know, with a mandate by Heinrich Himmler. He was part of Himmler's personal staff, being sent to look for the Grail and to report back when he found it. I mean, a bizarre concept, if you put your mind to it. Here's a man eventually in the full-blown SS uniform, you know, looking for the Grail. It's like something out of a bad movie also. Did he find it? That's the big question. He died quite mysteriously before the real war broke out. He had done a lot of research. He had been to the south of France in the Pyrenees looking for the Grail. He had been to Rennes-le-Château, which comes up again in the Da Vinci Code material and other books about it. He had been to the caves. He had been to Montségur. He was looking for the Grail everywhere. He wrote a couple of books regarding his searches, regarding paganism, very anti-Catholic, very anti-Christian, and then goes back to Germany, is sent to Dachau for training, because Dachau was both a concentration camp and a training camp for the SS. And shortly after his training was complete, he was dead. He was on a climbing in the hills and died of exposure, they say, in the spring in Germany. You know, an unbelievable story, but possibly murdered, you know, possibly even a suicide. We don't know.
The Spear of Destiny, was that one of the artifacts that was brought back to Germany?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a definite urge on Hitler's part personally to get the Spear of Destiny. He had seen it in Vienna in the museum there when he was a young man. And, you know, Hitler was obsessed with Wagner and the Wagnerian opera. So when he saw the spear, it was Parsifal, it was Tannhäuser, it was the whole Götterdämmerung coming at him with the sight of that. And what he wanted to do was to get that as well for the Germans. I mean, it was in Austria anyway, which he took over and where he was born. So the spear was taken from the museum, brought to Germany, and it was eventually replaced after the war. But the Spear of Destiny, the Holy Grail, some say the Ark of the Covenant, that's a possibility. There's some documents that talk about it. So there was definitely this idea that he wanted to accumulate all of these treasures in one place, and that Himmler and the SS was the force that was going out to do this for him. We don't know how many other things they brought back. They brought back a lot of things from Asia. They brought back a lot of things from the Middle East. We don't even begin to know how much that they did bring back and how much of it has since wound up in private collections around the world.
Mm-hmm. There was another artifact that was mentioned sort of tangentially in the Bible that's kind of intrigued me. In the book of Revelation, one of the messages from Jesus given to John is directed to the Church of Pergamum, in which he mentions that he knows that they are living in the seat of Satan's power, or something to that effect. They live at the seat of Satan's power. And I'd read that the Nazis took an altar from the Temple of Zeus at Pergamum and brought it back to Berlin. Do you know anything about that?
That story was prevalent, I believe, before the war started. This was when we had a lot of German archaeologists in the Middle East in the 1930s, after Hitler came to power in 1933. From 1933 to about 1938, Nazi archaeologists were all over the place, especially all over the Middle East, and they did take a lot of artifacts back from the Middle East and brought them back to Germany. That story I've heard. I don't know if it's true or not. Like I say, a lot of that information was destroyed at the end of the war. Himmler ordered a lot of documents destroyed. Hitler ordered a lot destroyed. So we don't know the provenance of some of these artifacts. We don't know where they came from. We don't know where they are now. But it's entirely possible they did. I mean, their interest in archaeology was not a purely academic one. Their interest in archaeology was something far deeper than that. Even Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence, ran into German archaeologists before World War I, who were, you know, always in the same area that he was in when he was a young archaeologist, and always looking for artifacts to bring back to Germany. This was something that was been going on for a long time, and it was not a purely academic research. These were practically grave robbers, you might say. They were just on a search and destroy mission. They just wanted to find what they could find and bring it back. So this was a kind of a culture of archaeology that went on that was sort of exacerbated when the Nazis took power.
How much of a believer was Hitler in the occult aspects of the Nazi belief system?
I believe from my reading of Hitler's own writings, from the talks that he had with other people, such as his photographer and Hans Stengel and some of the others, he did truly believe in the big picture occultism. I don't think he was so much concerned with, I mean, I can't imagine Hitler himself, you know, practicing ceremonial rituals. I think his idea was that, you know, as the leader of Germany, he was sort of the master magician. He didn't have to bother himself with such petty stuff like that. He had others to do it for him, you know, like Himmler. I could easily imagine, you know, performing occult rituals. But Hitler, no. I think Hitler saw himself as the Indians saw him, as a kind of avatar, as what I call in the book an occult messiah. I think that he believed in creating the new man. This is something that he mentioned many times. He believed in creating a new the next step of evolution, you might say. You might say a new type of human being. And he thought that in Germany they were going to do that. It was going to involve eugenics, racial theories. It was going to involve a new religion. You know, the SS abolished Christianity. You cannot be a Christian and be a member of the SS. All the religious rituals were changed. There was a kind of baptism, which was bringing into to the Aryan faith. There was a kind of Christmas thing, which was Yule, the old pagan holiday. Mm-hmm. You could not mention the word Christmas in any official documents of the Nazi Party, not just the SS, but Nazism in general. So there was a deliberate attempt to eradicate Christianity and to create a new human being that was composed not only of pure German blood, but a kind of pure German faith to go with it. So Hitler did believe, I think, very seriously in that. From everything I've been able to read, Hitler had this sort of Superman Nietzschean concept of what he was trying to accomplish.
But as far as the the nuts and bolts aspects of it, the ritual aspects of which Himmler for which Himmler is known, Hitler was not a participant in that at that level.
I don't think so. I mean, I've read a lot of speculative stuff about this. The book Spear of Destiny by Ravenscroft talks about Hitler attending seances and stuff, but there's been very little documentation to support it. I think when he was a young man in Vienna before World War I, he read a lot of this material. We know it's been documented. He read a lot of Ostara, this occult magazine. He drank it in. But I think I don't think he was out there performing rituals, or he may have attended a few just to see what they were all about. But Hitler was a kind of restless person and more of a man of action than anything else. And I don't see Hitler doing the prerequisite of fasting and meditating and all the rest of it. I think he wanted a quick way, you know, to gain power and using symbols and creating the Nuremberg rallies and performing ritual of that nature. Hitler was perfect for, you know, and he was trained in this, and he was trained in how to speak to people professionally, and he was trained by occultists. He was trained by hypnotists and magicians who taught him how to speak, who taught him how to move and how to express himself. All of these things he understood. And in those monstrous rallies he created, those were rituals. Anyone watching that could not come away with any other idea. These were rituals he was performing. And his speeches were incantatory. They were like chants. Even people who didn't understand German were swept away by it. And that's the stamp of a magician.
Well, I want to talk more about that as we continue and also get into the implications, or rather the consequences, of the growth of this belief system in the early part of the 20th century. How has that impacted history in the years after World War II? We'll do that and when we continue our discussion with Peter Lavenda, the author of Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, tomorrow on PID Radio. Information about Peter's books is available at his website, which is www.sinisterforces.info.
And when it comes to guests, we have one more installment, so to speak, with Peter Lavenda. And, of course, that will be up tomorrow night. And then on Friday, we may have a special guest with us. So you want to stay tuned for that. Ordinarily, we've got Blather on Fridays.
Yes.
But we think there may just be something new, and we're not going to tell you a whole lot more than that.
Right. So be prepared.
And it's not Nicole.
No, not this weekend.
Even though that would be great. More Nicole. We keep getting emails.
That's right.
Nicole for president.
Next week, Eric John Phelps will talk about the JFK assassination and the hand of the Jesuit order
the
assassination.
That's right. And of course, starting on July the 11th, as of right now, we have it scheduled for the Frog Brothers to make their mighty return.
Yeah, those guys are great.
The following week, we have scheduled Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin.
Yes, and we will. That's an interview I really look forward to.
I know. That is going to be great. And you're doing that this weekend, is that?
Well, no, don't have it confirmed. We think we're going to do that after the 4th of July.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there is a lot coming up. And, of course, with the 4th of July, we're going to see more and more stories floating around there and people speculating about what may happen. Because that, if you're going to find a holiday that represents America, it's got to be July the 4th.
And there are other things going on this weekend that are of interest. Of course, we've got that close flyby of the asteroid.
On the 3rd.
On the 3rd. Yeah. And then Saturday, the 1st, the shuttle will launch at about a little before 3 o'clock Central Time on Saturday afternoon. And the reason we're paying some attention to it, of course, is that story we mentioned last night where several engineers were basically kicked off the project for requesting caution
and seeing that there may be some safety issues that they're not comfortable with yet.
Yeah, exactly. And we've also got stories, of course, of terror cells mm-hmm. in Florida.
Homegrown.
Well, oh, we've come to the end of another show, honey.
Well,
where does the time go?
It really does go quickly when we do this. This is the high point of my day.
You know, it is mine too. And you know, we've had a number of emails, people who are concerned that we won't be able to continue PID. Don't fret. If God provides and God chooses for mm-hmm. PID to remain on the air, it will.
Yeah.
The only reason that things would change is if God makes it clear to us that we're to change things.
Yeah. So even though we are moving slightly to the left on your Rand McNally, we don't have any plans at this time to change what we're doing. But as we've said before, with the changes in schedule, we just can't foresee how things are going to shake out even a month ahead.
That's true.
So we'll do the best we can to keep things going because we enjoy doing this.
We really do.
And it is... Well, from the standpoint of my new job, the career that I'm rejoining, a lot of what we do for this program is stuff that I would be doing for that job anyway, just mm-hmm. staying on top of what's happening in the news and trying to make sense of it all.
And you're going to be like a kid in a candy store.
It is going to be a joy, and I'm just really thankful for the opportunity. So hopefully, and it's our prayer that we'll be able to keep on doing this on a regular schedule, and we will keep you apprised, of course. Our email address for your comments and questions and stories that you find that we may not have seen peering into radio at peeringintodarkness.com.
And if you want to stop by the forum, we'd love to have you join up. It's peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Until tomorrow night, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here. Don't let the hard times get you down. Older days will disappear. There's a new day coming now.
TID Radio.